Hi, I'm Justin. I'm an alcoholic. And, Gary, I'm going to try and, you know, keep this talk as clean as possible, and so you don't have to delete or omit anything. You know, my language is cleaned up a little bit. So have I since I got here and got sober. My sobriety date is February 7th of 2008. It is not my first attempt at sobriety, so I'm not one of those one-chip winners that you might see, but I'm one of those knuckleheads that keeps trying and trying, and, you know, until I tried it the AA way, I couldn't get it right. So thank God I have a sponsor today who's taken me through the book and shown me, you know, basically through this instruction manual, you know, this Design for Living that has taken me out of the gutter and put me in a place where I never could imagine. You know, my home group, grateful to be a part of my home group, which I joined in 2005, Jaywalkers. We're on Tuesdays and Fridays, and some of you have been there. And if you haven't, and you're in Richmond or in the south side of Bon Air off of Huguenot Road, come see us. We'd love to have you. Maybe recruiting some of you to speak, hopefully. I'm not the speaker getter right now, but when that job is mine, I probably will be knocking on your door or calling Sam or Billy or one of you guys out there to come share with us, because we'd love to have you. On Friday nights, we have a speaker meeting. I was on the phone with my sponsor today on the way here, and he gave me the same instructions that he always gives me: tell the truth. So that's what I'm going to do tonight, is just tell the truth. And something I wasn't very good at when I got here, but we get better at it as time goes. And, you know, that first level of honesty is finding out that I was powerless over alcohol. Well, I knew that truth since I was 13. When I was 13, my parents divorced. I'm going to just jump right in and tell you what I used to be like. And when I was, I was born in Connecticut. My parents, they were old hippies. You know, they went to Woodstock, and they lived out on this farm up in upstate Connecticut. And I remember one night when my father was staying out in the stables, because we used to take care of these horses. We were caretaking on this property, and you know, he was into horticulture. He grew some, you know, plants and stuff like that. And so they were laid back bunch of people, you know, motorcycles and people coming and going all the time. It was a blast. We had a couple of dogs. We had Ralphie, this one little, I don't know what it was. He was quick, and he could, you know, bounce a ball on his nose. And we had this big St. Bernard that I used to ride like a horse. His name was Titus. And I remember these things at 3 years old, and I don't know why, but I couldn't tell you what I did last night. You know, and that's pretty much how my brain worked all my life. You know, there were certain parts of my life that I could never shake, never let go of, or couldn't never forget. But more consistently, my short-term memory tended to just dissipate as quick as sand running through my hand. I couldn't remember what you told me last night or what I did last week. But that memory is coming back by the grace of God, and through staying sober, my mental faculties do sort of reestablish themselves as a result of this awakening. So for that, I'm grateful, because I had drank a lot. And when I was 3 years old, at my father's, in the stables, we were watching The Honeymooners. All right? It was 11 o'clock at night. Don't ask me how I can remember this at 3 years old, but I can tell you ad verbatim the smell of the hay. Back there was a space heater, a little 12-inch TV, black and white. Honeymooners were on. Dad, why are we out here in this, you know, why are we staying in this room? Things aren't working out. They split up, and, you know, that's why I became an alcoholic, point blank, you know. I mean, everybody's got to have some reason, right? It's not my fault, you know. They didn't do it right, you know. And that's what I carried with me, that badge of honor of, you know, why my plight was so tough, and I had to, you know. And I had really loving parents, and I didn't have a rough childhood. We were middle class, I guess. And when my dad left, he left out of the country to Spain for a year, and when he moved back, he moved to Lynchburg, Virginia, and I was up in Connecticut. So we didn't have a close relationship growing up. My mother remarried with a Vietnam vet, who was basically my father figure for the next 10 years, from the time I was about 4 or 5 until I was 13, 9 years, I guess. And he was a great guy, you know, the father figure that I had in my life until I was 13. And you know, played sports. He introduced me to a lot of things, and, you know, trapping, skeet shooting, hockey, you know, just the whole nine yards. Got into road racing, bicycles. I mean, just a lot of interesting things. And he was a fascinating guy in my eyes as a kid, you know, because he seemed to be doing a lot of really fun things. And he was into motorcycles. I got into motorcycles when I was little like that. And I had a mini bike, and I enjoyed that. And I had friends in my neighborhood, and we had a really good time, you know, Halloween, going out in the neighborhood, you know, just everything. I mean, it was just a great time. And when I was 13, my mother came down with cancer, and she had to have an operation and go through chemotherapy. When she did that, and I was, you know, and then they broke up at the same time. It was like right in succession, you know, these two things happened, and I started fearing that I was going to lose my mother, and I no longer had, you know, this father, quote unquote, in my life, and things were going to change. And we lived right on the in the suburbs in Connecticut, right across the border from New York. So we were like suburbs in New York City, basically, in Stamford and Greenwich, Connecticut. And I envisioned we were going to live in like the South Bronx in some torn up, you know, co-op apartment building, because she wasn't really working that much when they split up. And, you know, his family was well-to-do. His father was, you know, into design to the Model T or something like that, you know, back in the 40s, I guess, and, you know, made money as an engineer. He had an inheritance of that. So, you know, his career really wasn't contingent upon making a whole lot of money, because there was inheritance there. So when we left, that was no longer part of our lives, and that was kind of gone. And then, you know, I just feared that we were going to be, you know, just living in the ghetto. And it wasn't that bad. We ended up staying in a condo, and that was home for the next... Well, after that split, we stayed at my grandparents for about a year, and I can remember. I'm sorry. That was when my father and mother split. What happened was, is at 13, I thought I was going to lose my mother, and she was going through the chemo, and everything was uncertain. It was a 2-year process, or a year and a half at least, and I had already experimented, tried, you know, a Schaefer beer out of my grandfather's refrigerator. I, you know, got in the creme de menthe, you know, in my grandparents' liquor cabinet. Mixed a vodka orange juice, a screwdriver, like I'd seen my mother do, because that was her drink. And I tried my grandmother's scotch, because at 4:30 she would always have a glass of scotch, and she would sit there and look out the window and watch the birds and drink her scotch, and she'd get rosy cheeks and then go make dinner. And, you know, she was always real sweet and friendly around 4:30. She was a little grumpy at 3, so don't mess with her then. But 4:30, she was good to go. So we eventually moved out of my grandparents, and it was just my mother and I. And at that point, I had relied on my friends. And they were, you know, the older kids on the block, they were my new role models. And we lived just up the hill from an apartment complex, and there were some kids there that were into always up to no good, and they became, you know, friend, we all became friends, and we were just constantly doing things we shouldn't have been doing. But I didn't really have an experience with alcohol that was notable until I got to Karina Robinson's in the 7th grade. I moved to a lot of different schools growing up, and this was my second middle school, and I was the new kid on the block, and I just came from the inner city of Stamford, Connecticut, where, you know, the clothing, the style, everything was going on differently. And I go into this school, and the kids were much more kind of preppy, and you know, my clothes didn't, you know, I just felt a little awkward, and that was adapting into, you know, what was, you know, the normal, and that what was the norm in that school. And I was pretty good at adapting and becoming a chameleon and just kind of fitting in wherever I went if I had to, and made friends. And I had two close friends, and we went to this party, and, you know, there was the popular kids, there were the jocks, and I wasn't either one of those at the time. I was, you know, new, and I just had Peter and Paul, and they were my best buddies. And we go in, and we see the liquor cabinet. Her parents are gone, and we asked Karina, we said, hey, can we drink some of that vodka, you know, and we wanted to get into it. And she said, not all of it, because we don't want to, you know, don't want the parents to find out, and no problem. So we sit there at the island and grab that bottle of vodka, and there was nothing to mix it with but Diet Coke, and we poured, you know, not mixologists at 13, we just poured, you know, three quarters, you know, like four fingers of vodka in a highball glass, and about maybe one or two fingers of Diet Coke in there, and swirled it around and tried to sip, and it was the most vile combination, lukewarm, that you could possibly make. And I thought, why the hell do people drink this crap, you know? So what does anybody who wants to find out what a glass of this vodka and Diet Coke do? They chug it. I mean, you know, get rid of that, you know, nasty taste as fast as possible. And I remember the warmth and then, you know, that feeling that we get. And it was not instantaneous, but probably within 20, 30 seconds, I felt the warmth and the stirring. And I no longer cared what the preppy kids and the jocks and all the kids that I didn't really know if I fit in with were thinking anymore. I had not a care in the world. All I cared about was, well, should we do another one of these? And that's what I did, was a couple more of those and maybe four more or three more. And the bottle was gone, and I blacked out. And I just basically passed out, knocked over stuff, fell on my head, cut my head open, made out with some girl that I never thought I would with, and, you know, and people were watching, and it was embarrassing because, you know, it was just an awkward situation. I woke up with different clothes on in the middle of the night. It was just crazy, and I was really ashamed. I mean, it was, but in the midst of the party, I mean, it wasn't like in some room. It was like I was in the hallway in the entry of the house, waking up, and nobody else had that experience that night. That was just me, you know, right here, winner, winner, chicken dinner. I was the one, you know, and I woke up the next day. You know, I passed out right in front of the speaker. The music was blaring, and I can remember U2 was blaring in my ear, and I could barely even hear it. I was so passed out, drunk, and I woke up and I was feeling really shaky. I don't know if anybody woke up with that feeling where you just your whole body is trembling, and I was kind of scared because there was a lot going on, and I don't remember it all, but the stuff I do remember was really shady. I was like, man, every time I thought about what I could remember, I just kept shaking my head. I was like, my God, you know, and inside, I kind of made this promise to myself that I was never going to drink like that again. Not to that extent, at least. I was going to drink to the point where I can control it and enjoy it, just like the book talks about. You know, I didn't say it in those words, but in my mind, I'm like, I'm not going to be that guy anymore. I'm going to have fun, but I'm not going to have that out of control. So what do? I spend the next year and a half, you know, passing out at my doorstep, you know, puking out of people's cars and trying to find out what that limit was for me, you know, where the gentleman cuts off, you know, and you know, and trying to find that happy medium. And I couldn't find it until I was about 17 or 18 years old. And then my drinking was really tempered to a point where I could make it look normal and I could hold it back. And I wasn't a puker. I was a blacker outer. You know, I was like, you know, don't remember, but it was fun, wasn't it? You know, and I enjoyed it. What I did remember, I thought it was funny. There was no consequences. I didn't have to pay rent, didn't have to keep a job. You know, I had part-time jobs that didn't start until after school, so I couldn't really be late for that. And the consequences were at a minimum. Back in where we grew up, if we got pulled over, caught without open containers or drunk in public, you know, we got a slap on the wrist. Don't come around here. If we see you any more tonight, we're going to take you down to the police station. A couple times we did get taken down to the police station for other substances, drunk in public, that type of stuff. But, you know, underage, they only make you call your parents and have them come pick you up at the police station. So that happened a few times. And, you know, that was just part of the whole thing. I mean, that's comes with the territory, right? I mean, if you want to have fun, you're going to take those chances sometimes. And that's pretty much how I wrote it off. I didn't think much of it. Got into other substances. This is an AA meeting. I'm an alcoholic, tried and true. I've tested myself a few times. Like I said, I didn't have one sobriety date. I went out and tried controlled drinking, and it lasted for about maybe one drink. And the rest was completely out of my control. You know, I had control over picking up that first one, but after that, I didn't have control over when I was going to put it down. That's what makes me an alcoholic today, is that, you know, when I start, I can't tell you when I'm going to stop, and when I do stop, I can't tell you that I can stay stopped. So when I was 17, I quit high school because I had a girlfriend who was graduated, and she wanted to go follow the dead, and that's what we did, man. A lot of drinking around the clock and substances around the clock, and, you know, a lot of fun times and living in a tent. And we got to the point where we almost got busted and chasing, you know, figured the cops or the DEA or somebody was after us. And we ran off to this state park and stopped following the band, to, you know, and left the whole scene and, you know, hid out in this park for a couple of months and tried to save some money selling some marijuana and other things to try and raise money to buy this old beat-up Datsun B210 that we were going to drive out to California and start a new life. And I was 17 at the time, and you couldn't have told me anything other than that was what was going to happen, because that's what I was going to do. And when I come up with a genius idea like that, I'm going to stick to it. things didn't, you know, go so well in the tent after a couple of months. You get tired of taking bird baths at the Friendlies down the street, and you know, on a rainy night when you're waiting for one of your friends to come by and pick you up to take you back to their place to shower and they don't show, it's, you know, you just kind of hang out. And it was an adventure until it wasn't fun anymore. One day I was, you know, under the influence of psychedelics, and I'm out there just waiting for something to happen in my life, just like every day. And one of my buddies comes around and says, "Hey, your mom's here." I said, "She doesn't even know where I am. I haven't talked to my father in over a year and a half, and I haven't talked to my mother in at least 3 months after I left high school and went on tour." And he said, "No, she's here. She's over there on the park bench behind the tree." And I go over there, and we had a long, long talk. Don't remember what we talked about, but I was paying attention to what the squirrels were doing, and, you know, everything was sparkling, shiny. I was, like I said, I was having another moment, and she was having, you know, trying to get through to me, and I was on another planet at that time. And she had me call my father, and I really didn't know how to converse with people at that point. You know, I was used to talking in short, choppy sentences, like, you know, "Yeah, man," or just, you know, really didn't have much of a dialect going on in my life at that time. It was really difficult to have a conversation with him, because he was asking me real deep questions like, "How are you?" And you know, when you try and figure that one out, it gets really complicated, because, you know, how do you explain what you're seeing to your dad over the phone? Because it's just not normal, you know. So she did warm me up to the idea of coming back home, which lasted 36 hours until she got sick of me and gave me a bus ticket to go to my father. She says, "You know, if you're not going to live under my rules, you know, you're going to have to go somewhere. And I've decided to give you a bus ticket to go down and live with your dad." And I managed to go down and make things look okay for a year. And he lured me in by telling me he had a car that just needed a little bit of work. And, you know, of course, there's got to be a kick in it for me. I'm a selfish son of a bitch. If there's nothing in it for me, I just don't want to bother, you know. And that's just the MO, you know. I'm not really going to go because I want to be a good son and I want to see you, Dad. What do you have down there that's worth me coming down there for? Otherwise, I'll just live in the park like I have been, where it's real fun. And, you know, so I go down there and, you know, go back to school and show up every day for class. And I managed to get, like, B's, C's, a couple of A's. So I went from failing my 10th, 11th grade year to, you know, repeating my 11th grade year and getting, you know, B's, C's, and a couple A's, and worked on that car, which you know, he taught me a valuable lesson that I can, you know, if I want to put my mind to something, I can accomplish things, because I wanted to give up every day, and I was like, "Screw this damn car," you know, because when he showed it to me, I was heartbroken. I was resentful at him, because I was like, "You lied, you son of a bitch." Because I got to there at the lot where these Volkswagen Bugs were, and there was like hundreds of them. It was like a graveyard for Volkswagens. And I said, "Well, which one is it?" You know, I was thinking it was going to be one that ran or something like that. And he points to this one over there, and it's got like bushes growing out of it and everything. And fenders are all rusted out, and the motor's in the front seat. And I was just like, "Oh, really? You know, you're going to tell me it needs a little work? You know, and I look in the car, and you can see friggin' trees and weeds growing up through the floorboards. And, you know, so, I mean, it needed a lot of work. It didn't need a little work. I'm like, you know, I felt deceived. So I got over it, though. But he got me down there, and he did a, you know, and I love my dad, and I, you know, one thing I just never was to my family was a good son, and that's something that I came in here and realized at in AA, that, you know, I spent my whole life pointing my finger at my parents when all they tried to do was love me and teach me something that, you know, everybody tries to learn either in church or from your teachers, you know, basic principles that we come back to in AA. I mean, how to be, you know, honest, how to be, you know, how to respect other people, how to love other people, you know. Something I didn't know how to do. I spent the whole time trying to figure out how to love me more. Didn't know how to love you. I'd like you until you loved me the way I wanted you to love me, you know. I try to make that, you know, self-seeking to my benefit, you know. And I didn't see that until I got into my fourth step and all that, all fun stuff. And my sponsor helped me see those things, because had I done a fourth step without a sponsor, I probably wouldn't have seen but what I wanted to see. And it was probably, sir, like, well, I was 50% wrong and you were 50% wrong. And I was not willing to look at, you know, exactly where I was selfish and self-centered. And that's the beauty of this program, is it snaps me right back into the here and now, and exactly who I am and what I'm dealing with. And, you know, the ignorance is bliss until you can't run from it anymore. You know, I can try and drink to drown my sorrows and my resentments and my fears, but all that stuff can swim. And it started swimming when I was about, I finally got a GED. I'm going to fast forward. And I went on to culinary school because I wanted to get out of the house. I didn't want anybody to tell me what to do. And we were talking about this earlier, you and I were, and about my defiance and how that plays a major role in authority. And don't tell me, I already know. And how could you possibly know what's best for me? I know me better than anybody. And that sort of defiance and arrogance played a part in most of my decisions based on, you know, when somebody would try and give me advice, I would almost immediately just shoot it down because I thought I had a better idea. I didn't know what that idea was yet, but I knew it was going to be better. And that's exactly the closed-minded mentality that I brought around with me everywhere I went, because I thought I knew me best, and I didn't know me at all. And that's what I came in here to find out, is that I absolutely had no clue who Justin was when I got here. I was a scared kid who never learned how to grow up because I relied on alcohol and other substances to take care and manage of all my emotions, all my affairs. And when they started to wreck my affairs and all, I became an emotionally unbalanced individual, you know, my life reflected in every corner of it. It was a reflection in my life. But I did manage to finish this culinary school. I went there and I wanted to be a chef, because at 18 years old, I got the GED and I went to visit this culinary school, and I got a loan and they accepted me. And I think if you could sign your name and write a check, they would accept you. So I was a winner, you know, and I got in. But it was a tough school to graduate from. It was they actually did, you know, have some challenging. It was a challenging school, and I did make a career out of it. But not until I became a complete failure. After I graduated, I went out west and finally got out to California and started working in a 5-star hotel after I graduated from culinary school. And it all looked like promising to me. I mean, I had a really good career job, you know, big company, Ritz-Carlton, and really good job. And even one of the guys that I was in the kitchen with working as a banquet chef, and he was moonlighting at this house where he was a private chef, and he was leaving that gig, and he says, hey, are you interested in taking over this gig for me? And it was cooking a 5-course meal one night a week for 6 or 7 people for this real hotshot real estate broker in the marina up from the Palace of the Fine Arts in San Francisco. It gives you a free apartment, you know, a monthly salary. All your expenses, food and drink, are paid for. All you have to do is go shopping on Wednesday and prep your meal and, you know, prepare it on Thursday night after you get off of work at the Ritz and bring it up, you know, 2 floors to the penthouse of this real estate broker's place and, you know, pour wine, serve the hors d'oeuvres and the soup or the salad and the appetizer and then entree and dessert. you know, wrap your stuff up, bring the bus tub downstairs, clean it up, and you know, your rent's paid for, and you got a salary, and plus you know, I had full-time salary from the Ritz-Carlton, and I'd been there for about a year, and I took on that job, so I had all income and no bills, none whatsoever. I had no bills whatsoever. I had to put gas in the tank of my motorcycle, and I was broke all the freaking time. I was so broke, I had to move my dealer into my one-bedroom apartment so that way I could get a discount on my, you know, party favors. And how does that happen, you know, at 22, 23 years old? I don't know. But that's how I started off, you know, just like completely oblivious to the fact that, you know, things might fall apart at any minute based on how I just had absolutely no control over, you know, when I went out. I really wouldn't be able to just stop and go home until the bartender would say, "We're closed now. You have to get out." And I would get out, and we would start looking at each other like people that just got kicked out of their home. Where are we going to go now? You know, who's got more? And it was always that question. And usually I would go into work at the Ritz, no sleep, you know, straight out of some after-hours bar, club, at 6 o'clock, and I would go take a hot shower and, you know, mouthwash and cologne and put on my chef coat and run up there and try and act like I had slept the night before, and I hadn't. And I started relying on other substances to keep me going throughout the day, and all that stuff caught up with me. And eventually that roommate of mine and I came out of a club one night and decided we were going to have a couple of people over. Well, a couple of people turned out to be about 65 people in a 400-square-foot little studio, one-bedroom apartment that lasted about 13 hours. And by about 3 o'clock the next day, the last few people were leaving my apartment through escorting of the police, and there was 4 squad cars when we came back from driving around that afternoon. And there was a bag of goodies and a wad of money, and I'm hiding in the bushes trying to figure out who was in the back seat. And I saw my roommate, and I saw a couple other people I knew. And as I was looking through the bushes, the police officer looked over, "Hey, do you live here?" And so we went into interrogation for a while, and turns out the neighbors complained about the people parked in the middle of the street and passed out on the yards, because we were in a really affluent neighborhood. That real estate broker had a house that was right next to the owner of the San Francisco Giants baseball team. So they weren't the people that you could just get away with having a bunch of yahoos out of some nightclub park in the middle of the street, blocking their traffic and passing out in their, you know, neighbor's yards. They kind of expected a little more civility, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. But that's not what I brought to the neighborhood. So, needless to say, that job lasted about another 36 hours until Lorenzo, the owner of the house, came home, found out from his neighbors what happened, called me at the Ritz and said, "Hey, when you get off work, come up to my house immediately." And I knew that didn't sound good, and I knew things were, you know, the axe was about to fall. And when he said he needed me out of there by tomorrow morning, I knew it was over. You know, I took a hint. And so I moved back to the Mission. And at that time, that was the only place where I could afford to live. And we usually lived in flats where we had about 4 or 5 roommates. And we lived above this bar called Donington Park. And that was really convenient. Everything started to go out of control at that point. The Ritz-Carlton job lasted about another 2 months. And I had come in late probably 7 or 8 times in a 3-month period. Not just 15 minutes late, I'm talking 2 hours late, 2.5, 3 hours late, because I would come home from drinking all night, and I would lay my head on the pillow at 5:30 in the morning, and I'm just going to sleep for 45 minutes, and at 6:15, I'm going to get up, and I'm going to roll out to work. I just need to close my eyes just for a minute, and I would wake up at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I would have that panic and that fear, and I would, you know, run into work, and they let me get away with that for about 7 or 8 times, and finally, his friend chef, called me into his office, and he said, "What's going on with you? I don't understand. What's wrong?" And I said, "Well, what?" like trying to figure out, like, I have no clue what you're talking about. And he says, "You've been late 8 times in a 3-month period. We only allow 3 in 1 quarter. What is going on with you?" And he had that sincere look in his eyes, that concern. You never had anybody ask you what's wrong with you, and they had that really concerned look on their face. like they really were wondering what's going on with you. Like, what is going on with you? And I couldn't answer. And I didn't know what was going on with me. Something beyond anything that I could describe was going on. I mean, I just don't know why I keep doing what I'm doing. And I don't know why I can't stop, even though I know that everything's on the line at this very moment. There's a much more powerful force going on in my life. You know, it's like once the undertow takes you out to sea, it's like, you know, before you know it, you're 100 yards out and you didn't realize it. You know, it's that powerful for me. I was already gone at that point, and I was powerless, and I felt that fear of not knowing what was wrong or what was going on. And when I left, I was heartbroken. I mean, that was my career job, and it was a devastation. It was major blow. I pretty much had a case of the efforts after that. You know, I would come with my little degree, and I would go in, and people would open the doors of their restaurant owners, and they would say, okay, come on and run the kitchen. I would come in, and I'd be the guy with a six-pack in his low boy reach-in cooler with a beer on the cutting board at 7 a.m. getting your restaurant ready for service for lunchtime. And when you come in and you ask me what's going on, I'm like, just getting breakfast ready. And they're like, no, what's the beer all about? And, you know, and that's when I just take my knife kit and walk out and say, well, you know, screw you. You know, you should be lucky to have a guy like me here. And that's the kind of arrogance that I walked around with, because I figured, you know what, you don't know where I came from and what I, you know, and that whole entitlement was there until it wasn't there anymore. And I was waiting in line at the government assistance office trying to get food stamps and basically proving that I was homeless, because eventually I became completely unemployable because my drinking and everything else took precedence over any other thing in my life. You know, the relationships were non-existent. I mean, I had friends, I had associates, but the thing they talk about in the big book where a pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization really jumped out at me when I first heard that in the big book, because that's where I started to feel that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, because I started to experience a level of lack of control and powerlessness that I never felt before in my life. And I started to see the direct results, and I had no power to stop it, none whatsoever. It was like I was caught in an avalanche, and there was nowhere to go but down. And I mean, there was nothing that was going to hold any ground to keep me from going anywhere but down. And that's where I went. And it was almost like I've heard so many people share, you know, get to that point where I can't lower my standards fast enough to keep up with the decline in my life. You know, I would start pointing my finger at some, you know, schlep out there on the streets, and I'm like, man, if I ever get as bad as that guy, I'm getting out of this game whatsoever. And next thing you know, I'm looking up to him, you know, like show me what to do here, bud, you know, like, you know, that's how ridiculous it was. And I ended up living in this house where it was a really bad scene. And I picked up a drug charge, a distribution charge and felony. And I had some money saved from the things that I was going on. And I, like I said, I hadn't held a job. Or hadn't been able to hold a job, but I got caught doing this thing and doing these transactions. And what happened was is, I had to fork over a lot of money and borrow some money to pay for this really good lawyer to, you know, get me off no time from when a guy who got, charged for distribution of less LSD at that time, he got 10 years straight up. And I had more, and I was fearing that I was going to get minimum of 10 years. But they looked at my past history, and they looked at, you know, this guy went to culinary school. He was working in, you know, in establishments, and he's, you know, his background checks out. And he's like, well, the judge gave a plea bargain. If I plead guilty to a felony of distribution LSD, I'd be doing 350 community service hours and 5 years of probation. I said, I didn't have to say a word. I just went into court, walked out. Everything was done deal. I didn't have to do any time. I go over to my probation officers right out of court. Greg Norman, I can still remember him, still remember what he looks like, his desk, his office. And we sat down, and I was this nervous little kid, you know, 24 years old. And I'm thinking, you know, I just dodged a huge bullet, you know. And I didn't have to tell my family, you know, because I was worried if I was going to get thrown in the hooscow for a long time, I would have to call my family, because eventually, after a couple of years, they'd wonder where I was. And I knew they were wondering about me the whole time, because I wasn't a good son. You know, I wouldn't call on birthdays or Christmases or anything like that, because, you know, I'd wake up all of a sudden one day, and I'd be sitting in the bar, and I'm like, wow, how come it's so slow in here? They're like, it's Christmas Day. I'm like, oh, shit, give me another one, you know? Damn, that's another reason to drink, you know? And that's kind of how it was for about 4 or 5 years. I just didn't pay attention to, you know, seasons or holidays or family or anything like that. I was more consumed with self-pity or where I was going to get what I needed to get through the day, because I just couldn't function without it. And couldn't make job interviews. Back to Greg Norman at the probation officer, he said, look, I'm not going to make this difficult for you. I just want you to come in, see me every Tuesday at 3 o'clock. Can you do that? Can you be here at this office every Tuesday at 3 o'clock? I said, yeah, I can do that. And he says, all right, well, you know, you've got to do these community service hours. And you've got to come downstairs, show up in the truant office or whatever place it was. He says, you're going to come down there 7 o'clock sharp. All right, they're going to give you your uniform, and you start your community service hours tomorrow, bright and early. Can you do that? I can do that. I'll be there. And you know, immediately in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I'm not going to wear one of those stupid orange jackets and poke trash and put it in a bag around the street so my friend's going to laugh at me. Like, I had people that were really looking at what I was doing at that time, because I had it going on, you know. What happened was I walked out of his office and with such a resentment, I mean, such a powerful resentment towards the law, towards the guys that turned me in, towards the probation officer. And these people didn't do anything. I mean, they were just there, you know. And I walked out of there with such a resentment. I'm like, the world owed me something, you know, and I wasn't doing anything wrong. And I never showed up back there, you know. Not for the next 3 years. I just kind of hustled around the streets and survived and did what I did. And I never stepped foot in his office ever again, and never did not 1 second of community service hours. And after about a week, I didn't even think about it anymore. I was so wrapped up in the life that I was living and drinking around the clock. And I had places to go, but I didn't want to have my name on a lease. So I kind of kept my stuff in this guy Mario's garage. And that's where it stayed for the next 3 years. And he was sort of my home base for those 3 years that I was out doing my thing, because I would get out and I would run as hard as I could. And after about 3 or 4 days, when I was completely burnt out and, you know, done at the end of my binge, I would go back and say, hey, I need to take a shower. I got to, you know, and I would always come up with the same. I don't know how he had the patience, but, you know, he always, you know, had an open hand to take me back in and have hopes that I was going to go back and get another job like I was at the Ritz, because he knew me when I was at my, you know, when I was doing okay for a little bit there, for a year and a half. And so he always had hopes, and he's like, you know, and when my mother wanted to find out where I was, and she was in the Peace Corps, she survived the cancer, by the way, and she's doing well, she's happily alive today, she's working as a school teacher, and getting ready to retire, and she was in the Peace Corps in North Yemen at the time, and when she'd call or try and touch base, she was out of the country, she would call his house to find out where I was or how I was doing or if I was still alive. And he would answer, and he would say, you know. And he was like one of those functioning alcoholics, you know, those people that can hold a job, you know, keep the house and manage and still party. And I wasn't. I was one of those unmanageable low-bottom drunks. And I don't think I'll ever be anything but that if I ever drink, because I've tried two other times after I got sober, the first time in 95, and I mean, I even stayed sober for 7.5 years the first time. And when I stopped doing AA and I stopped doing what we do in here, it's like going up the down escalator. You know, I just stopped moving my feet in AA, and all of a sudden I'm working the steps in reverse, and that's what happens, you know, and I don't get better like it talks about in the big book. It's like, you know, even no matter how long I stay you know, away from a drink, my drinking, if I ever return to it, it never gets better, it always gets worse, just like it says, and that's been my experience. But Mario would answer the phone, he would tell my mother what was going on, or not really what was going on, but he would try and give the best version of what was going on. to the best of his knowledge, which I kept him basically in, you know, in the dark about everything. I would always come up to his door and say, hey, look, I want to go to this job interview tomorrow. Can I take a shower and stay at your place? And he'd let me stay. And then sometimes I'd have a victim, you know, a girl that I'd meet at a bar, and she'd, you know, for some reason buy the BS that I was, you know, like I had another place somewhere across town, and I had a job, and I didn't have any of that. And I was just, you know, that guy in the bar with a backpack, you know, with no place to go that night. And I was just drinking, to kill time. And that's what I did. And when I needed fresh clothes, I would sit there at the laundromat, and I'd wait for some guy who walked in, had my size, and, you know, looked like he had decent clothes, and he put his stuff in the wash, and then he put it in the dryer, and by the time it was in the dryer, and he's getting ready to go get a cup of coffee down the street, you know, as soon as he hits the road, I go over, grab his fresh, clean clothes, and put on some clean clothes, and go back out to the bar and look good again, you know, nice new pair of jeans and a shirt and everything, and I looked all right, you know, and I tried to play the part, you know, I had this, you know, character that I wanted to present to the rest of the world, because I had this, you know, ego that still thought that I could manage somehow. Meanwhile, I'm waiting in line at the soup kitchen because I don't want to spend my last $20 on anything but liquor. And I didn't think anything about it. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. 24-year-old sitting there in line at the soup kitchen with these guys that, you know, can't work, you know. And I can work, you know, but I can't, you know. But I can't, you know. I can work, but I can't, you know. Because I can't manage to make it to it. I couldn't even manage to make it to a job interview. I remember leaving several times to go to job interviews, and I'd get down the street, and I'd run into so-and-so, and before you know it, I'd be gone for 3 or 4 days. And I'd come back, you know, with the same clothes that I left to go on the job interview, and 4 days later. And eventually it caught up to me, and I was up on this fire escape of the Seedy Hotel down on Market Street. And that's when, you know, divine intervention happened, and the law caught up with me, and I ended up, getting sober in jail, and the state took over my treatment, you know. And I called my father, who I hadn't talked to in about 2.5 years, and he said, why don't you go to treatment here in Virginia? And that's what got me to Virginia. And when I got released, I went to this outpatient treatment, and they talked about euphoric recall and triggers and all that stuff, and I was miserably sober for about 60 days, about ready to take my next check, buy a beat up car and drive back out west and show all my friends that I was doing well, you know. But I was miserable inside. I couldn't stand living without a drink. I was absolutely miserable. I hadn't gone to any meetings that they had been suggesting the whole time I was at that treatment center, because I figured I had to go for 3 days a week, 3 hours a day. That was way more than enough for me. But I was one of those guys that drank 24 hours a day, and I'm trying to negotiate 3 hours a day. You know, the math just doesn't add up until I get sober and I really look at how much energy and time I spend into my drinking. You know, what I get when I come to a meeting and spend, an hour on the weekends with my sponsor going through the big book, and what has happened to me just through that little investment in AA has paid back dividends. I mean, I don't think I'd have anything close to the life I have without what I've been shown in AA. So I stayed sober for 7.5 years after I got a sponsor in Lynchburg and went to meetings. And this guy took me under his wing and kind of walked me through the steps. I did my first, fourth, and fifth step with another man. I got 100% honest with him. And for the first time, all those dirty deeds that I did when I was out there, and I did some pretty bad things that I wouldn't want to talk to anybody about, didn't want to share about, sex conduct stuff that was just shameful. I was just, you know, like, man, I just wanted to hide from it. And I shared, and, you know, and he made me feel right at home, because, you know, the things that I was dreading and fearing the most about being judged or feeling uncomfortable about being inferior, he shared right off the bat. And he says, look, man, this is what happened, and this is what happened to me. And we had a bond that I'd never felt before with another human being, and that catapulted me into doing, becoming willing to form future ideals about relationships and looking at the fears that were dominating my life and how much I really wasn't this, you know, cocky, unafraid guy that I thought I was, because I grew up and I'd had guns pulled to my head more than once, twice, three times. You know, ever since I was 14, I was in shady, seedy places trying to get things that, you know, 14, 15-year-old kids shouldn't be getting. But when I got done with the steps, I was sponsoring guys and I was active. And then I came here to Richmond and I had this job and I had this wife, I had this kid, you know, and it was a beautiful life, you know. And I didn't see any problem in the horizon whatsoever. So I just kind of rested on my laurels. Like they warn us in the big book, you know. I started, you know, thinking that there's no way I'd ever drink again, you know, because I had just done so much, you know. And I started disagreeing with the way the boss ran things because I knew more than he did and I had better experience than he did. And I started to get back up into that egocentric thinking that, like, I knew how to run the ship better than the boss does. And we would get into these arguments, and then, you know, I'd come home and I'd have that on my mind, and I didn't want to talk to my wife, and I became distant. And then I started, you know, screwing around on the computer and looking for relief, but I couldn't find it anywhere. And I tried to find it in another relationship. And what happened was, is I became dishonest, you know, not very transparent. I wasn't calling my sponsor but once every 2 weeks. And I would go to a meeting once a week just to, you know, kind of check in and see how you guys were doing, make sure everybody was doing okay. And that's pretty much where I thought about, you know, was that I got this. I don't want to talk to my sponsor about the same old crap that's been going on in my life for the past year. He already knows it. Why want to bore him with the same old facts? But I was suffering inside, and I was suffering desperately. And I desperately needed to – I hadn't been helping anybody. I hadn't sponsored anybody in the last year. And when that drink came, I didn't even see it coming. It was a knee-jerk reaction. It was just an immediate response. It wasn't even a thought. If you'd asked me that morning, was I going to drink that day, I would have been, hell no. I'm sober. You know, I'm not going to drink today. But when that neighbor came over and she had a six-pack, and I said, give me one of those, I didn't even think. It was just, give me one, because I needed some relief and I didn't know where to get it. And that was like immediate recognition. You know, that hardwired circuitry to find relief in my brain has never died, and I don't think it ever will. You know, it's just hardwired in my brain. I know where to find relief. And if I don't have any defense, which is, you know, constant work with other alcoholics, prayer, meditation, a sponsor that I'm being transparent with and honest, you know, and being in the middle of this thing so I can get reminded of where I go back to, because, you know, I can build, you know, life can get comfortable for me and I can forget exactly where I go and where I came from. And if I forget where I came from, it's almost like I'm flying blind all over again, because I've got no compass. I've got no bearing on where I'm headed, because I could be totally turned around and headed back right where I came from and not even know it, because it all looks the same to me. I'm moving, you know, and motion doesn't equal, you know, getting busy is one thing, but getting busy in AA is another. So I drank again, and in 2 years I was, you know, homeless, jobless, and, you know, wifeless, and all by choice, you know, and because it all interfered with my drinking. And I was talking through a 2-inch thick glass window, talking to my future ex-wife, hey, I want to start going back to meetings as soon as I get out of here, because this sucks, and I never had it as good as I did when I was in AA. And you know, it took me, after I got released from jail, about another 6 or 7 months to make it to my first meeting. When I did, I came back in, I joined Jaywalkers, and that's my home group, and I've been active in that home group ever since. I've had a job in that home group ever since the day I walked in that door. You know, I started out as a vacuumer, and I hated vacuuming. I thought, you know, why did they shove me into this stupid job? I'm the last guy to leave this stupid meeting at the end of the night. And after about 3 weeks, I'm like, I love this job, man. I get to meet so many cool people. I got to know everybody in the meeting because I'm hanging out after the meeting, you know. What do I know about staying sober? Absolutely zilch, nada. And I had to get shown, you know, and it's a program of action. It's not something I can think my way into. I had to act my way into better living, and that's what my sponsor constantly reminded me. When I was going over to his house every weekend, and we would read that book, and he would read to me like a damn child. And I just, you know, could identify with what he was describing and how it related and how he experienced the big book and what these things meant to him. You know, the phenomenon of craving and the allergy and finding a God of my own, a concept of my own higher power. We didn't talk about higher power. He never talked about God. I just started praying one day. He says, why don't you just start praying, you know? And when we got to that point in the big book where, you know, I had to quit running the show. I had to quit playing God. And I started that third step prayer. And I say it every day. You know, it's still part of my program today. My prayers have expanded and gotten more intimate and even more intense and short. But in the beginning, I relied on those prayers straight out of the book because I didn't know any better. I needed something as a bearing to hold on to. Because I wasn't that creative. You know, I came in here all out of ideas this last time. I'm like, just show me what to do. you know, I'll leave all the girls in AA alone. I'm going to stick with you men for a while because, you know what, every time I would, you know, and I've got a broken picker. I'll pick the sickest one in the bunch, the one that's getting ready to go out and drink, you know. And that's the way it was, and that's part of my problem was that I wasn't taking sponsor suggestions and I kept drinking. I wasn't doing the steps as thorough, and I wasn't able to be transparent. You know, I think most people drink because something's missing, and it's usually honesty. You know, had I called my sponsor and told him what was really going on, we would have been able to get down to, you know, facts, you know. But I don't want to deal with that. I want to deal with my own ideals. So when I came in this last time, I was really willing to take all the suggestions and leave no stone unturned, and I do all of the suggestions. And I still call my sponsor twice a week. Now I'm going through some tough times. I'm calling him every day. I'm doing exactly what I did in the beginning to stay sober. I'm going to a meeting every day. I normally go to about 5 meetings a week. I sponsor other guys, and thank God I do that finally, because, I mean, I don't think I'd be able to do this thing if I didn't have any guys that I could, you know, think about. I'm thinking about their crap when I'm talking. When we're on the phone, it's great. I'm not thinking about me and my crap, you know. It's like I get to be there and walk through their crap with them and share what, you know, my sponsor shared with me. And the suggestions have never given me a reason to go back to my sponsor and say, yeah, that thing you told me to do, yeah, well, it didn't work. You know, I've never had that privilege of being able to tell him he's been wrong or the suggestions just didn't work for me. Every time I take him, my life just seems to get a little better, or I seem to get a little bit more okay inside and comfortable. And, you know, today, you know, I think I needed every drink to get here. I think it takes what it takes. You know, some of us have high bottoms, some of us have low bottoms. If, you know, I didn't tell your story tonight, or if I don't say anything that you can relate to, you know, there's always going to be somebody here next week or next month that's going to share something that, you know, might just hit completely home to you, and you might identify with them. And that's the beauty of this thing, is because we come from all different walks of life, and everybody's got slightly different variations of the same thing, you know, maybe to different extremities or whatever. But, you know, when I come in open-minded, I always hear something, you know, that I can truly identify with from everybody, even from the guys that are in my sponsor line that have complete opposite stories of me. One of my best friends, he had never lost a job, never came in late for work, didn't ruin his marriage, has the same house for the past 25 years, and managed to make it to work every day on time and drank like a fish. You know, and I look at him like a damn unicorn. I'm like, how the hell did you not burn all that shit up? You know, how? And I mean, but I love him like a brother. And we have, and it all looks the same to me. It's just the circumstances might be different around it. But the mental obsession and the compulsion is the same. You know, it's absolutely the same. So, you know, I know that a lot of people struggle because they come in here and they're like, my life still looks good. I still have an American Express card. How could I be wrong? You know, and that could be a tricky part. And I can imagine that I'd probably still be out there myself because I have such an ego that would convince me that. You know, so a guy like me needs to be stripped down, you know. I think leveling of my pride was absolutely necessary for me to get this thing, you know. And that I am so grateful for. In the beginning, you know, it stings a little bit because you're like, well, everything I think is just absolutely wrong. And well, you know what? Thank God, you know, because thank God, you know. The world, according to me, would be a really messed up place, you know. Thank God you guys are here to help show me how to live, you know. So today, you know, I haven't had the luxury, or I haven't had the you know, when I first started sponsoring guys, nobody stayed sober. Guys were going back to prison, drinking, and, you know, and I felt, what am I doing wrong? And I continue to work with people. And the book does, you know, Bill's story, of course, talks about how, you know, he couldn't, you know, help. You know, at the beginning, nobody stayed sober, and I completely experienced that, ad verbatim. I mean, I just couldn't, you know, just didn't seem to have any luck. Nobody stayed sober for the first year and a half. I was out helping guys, and I was reaching my hand out, and my sponsor would always point me in the direction of the guy that was getting ready to duck out of the meeting as soon as the prayer was over. And you know, and today that's just part of my program. Is some, when I go to a meeting, I'm not going there to see what I can get. I'm going there to see who I can, you know, hook up with, you know, where you've been, you know, you got a home group, And that's just what is basically what I've been shown to do is to make the new person feel welcome in here, because, you know, this is a strange place for somebody who hasn't had the opportunity to see what it's like to come one day at a time and not drink. Not drinking is a frightful idea. For me, it was. I mean, I was deathly afraid. I can't imagine it. Even as devastating and as bad as it gets, I still can't imagine with not having that relief. And the relief today I find is through working with others and through God and my understanding. God is a really powerful force that works in and through all of us when we are in here and engaged. And thank God for that. Thank God for God. Thank God for this program. And thank God for all you people. And I'm glad to be here and be able to, be here with you guys at the meeting tonight, and that's all.